Welcome to Let's Talk Memoir, a podcast for memoir lovers, readers, and writers. I'm your host, Ronit Plank. Today, my guest is Suzette Mullen, who is a memoir and nonfiction book coach, retreat leader, and the author of the memoir, The Only Way Through Is Out, published by the University of Wisconsin Press. Her essays have appeared in the New York Times, Today.com, and Brevity, among other outlets. As a book coach, Suzette guides writers to find their deeper stories and to find their big ideas. A graduate of Harvard Law School and Wellesley College and the mother of two young adult sons, Suzette made a big leap professionally and personally at midlife and now lives in Pennsylvania with her wife and their rescue pup. Welcome, Suzette.
Thank you so much, Ronit. I'm so excited to be here.
I am so excited to have you here. And I say, let's get started. Why don't you talk a little bit about your new memoir, The Only Way Through Is Out?
Yeah, so I think of my book as both a coming out and coming of age story and a call to action for every human who's longing to live more authentically, but is afraid of the cost. And the sort of high level plot level of the story, it's about my emergence at midlife from deep denial about my sexuality, and then the struggle to decide what, if anything, I was going to do about that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a beautiful way of explaining what your book is about. And it's a love story as well. I mean, it's a divorce story. It's a love story. It's a coming out story. It's a sister story in many ways as well. What I found really, I found it really interesting throughout the memoir when your sister and you are in a scene together and she would ask you stuff like, oh, is this the gay stuff again? Or is this, she would just like, you would be able to kind of get a portrait of who you've been to her throughout your life because she was calling stuff out that you hadn't totally engaged with.
Yeah, I think that's one of the themes and one of the things that I really noticed when I began writing was how this was kind of a big open secret, really. I mean, I think that many people, including myself, knew that this was true at some level, but staying in denial was working for everyone. So nobody, you know, we didn't make a change until the pain of staying the same was more than making a change.
Yes. And the reader, I, as a reader, really felt that throughout your book because I could see how much everything was building and all the contortions you had to put yourself through and all the considerations, because it is a giant decision to do what you did. There's no going back.
Yeah, I mean, we say this on the jacket copy because it's true. I was raised to play it safe and I was a rule follower. I was someone that was afraid of making mistakes. I was very, very risk averse. And so then I'm confronted with, you know, what is a life-changing decision, not only for myself, but for my family, my then husband. And it was terrifying because it wasn't the kind of decision that you can make and then go back on. It was the proverbial jump off the cliff kind of decision.
And I don't mean in what I said to make it sound like it was even a choice for you, that you could have, I mean, obviously you could have, I guess, made yourself continue on the way you had been, but I'm not trying to say that it was, you know, something that you could have easily ignored because it's who you are. So I just want to make sure I get that across.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought that up, and because I think there's a lot to say about how much choice plays a role in our sexuality. And what I believe and what I experience, our sexual identity is not a choice. It is who we are. But we do have a choice about how we decide to express it. And I certainly could have chosen to stay in my marriage to a man and stayed in my life that looked and was largely it was a heterosexual life. And I could have done that. And when readers read the book, they'll see that was a big part of the struggle. It was not an easy decision to make. On this mm-hmm. side of it, it feels perhaps like a simpler decision, but it did not feel that way at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would love to talk about your writing process. What in writing this memoir came to you without maybe too much difficulty, and what challenged you more?
Yeah, so I think that, and this is true, I think, for many memoir writers, if not most, the plot level, the things that happened, of course, I knew what those were. I lived them, I experienced them, mm-hmm. and I had a pretty clear, you know, what we call story present, that timeline of when the story got set in motion and when the story ended. What came easily for me was the ending. I had kind of a perfect storybook ending that, you know, the universe provided. And so I went with that. And I know a lot of memoir writers, because I also am a book coach and I work with memoir writers, that sometimes the ending's hard to figure out because, of mm-hmm. course, your life goes on. But for me, the ending was always clear. I really did struggle. I struggled with two things. One was where to enter the story. And I mean, I cannot tell you how many different beginnings I had. And in fact, what's on page one, or the first page of the book now, only made it on there in the very final revision. I mean, after the book was sold, mm-hmm. and I was incorporating feedback from the peer reviewers, because I published with the University Press and there was a peer review process, that was when I finally landed on what was going to be on page one. So page one, or the very, very opening, where do you actually start, was mm-hmm. difficult. And then, you know, again, not an uncommon issue for memoir writers is how to structure the story. I did decide pretty early on that I would have a loosely chronological telling of the story. I had the ending, and I wanted to have a bookend to the ending mm-hmm. that communicated the journey and the narrative arc. But then what to do with all the other material, all the things that happened before the story started on page one, and how to incorporate those, how to structure those. And I'm very happy with where I landed, but it wasn't easy getting there.
Oh, I'm so glad we're talking about this, because I do agree with you. Structure is really something that confounds memoirists, and some people can't even begin to structure it until they've got their material. I'm curious how you knew to ultimately settle on the way that you did begin the book, because, you know, you can change it all the time. Mm-hmm. We can justify lots of ways to start our books. And the ending, you're right, did come in a perfect shape, I think, because of it was your real life. But the beginning, you have countless options.
Yes.
So when you hit that one, how did you know? Was it your peer reviewer that told you? Was it your editor? How did you know, yes, this is what I needed? What were readers asking you for that you had to fulfill?
Yes. So the peer reviewers, there were two peer reviewers, and their feedback was super helpful. They did not have a solution. they didn't offer me a solution for the opening, but they found the first 2 to 3 chapters a bit mushy, a bit problematic, that it wasn't tight enough. And so they identified the problem. And so I went back, and I was also working with a book coach. I worked with book coaches as the writer on and off throughout the process. And my number one person, I'll give her a nice shout out, Julie Arts, who's also a friend. She was, you know, we worked on that opening together. However, what I literally ended up putting on that first on those first pages, when I showed that to Julie, I mean, days before my draft was due, it was new material to her. And she was like, oh my gosh, you know, what have you done? But it worked. And I think how I landed was, I think a book, a memoir is, it's a journey to answer a question. And I was very clear, as I've mentioned, about where I landed at the end, where I was. And so I kind of worked backwards and I said, well, what's a moment that I can start the book with where I am raising the question that I'm trying to answer throughout the book? And the scene, the opening scene, is a scene with my husband, and we're having a conversation about what am I going to do with my life? Because and it really did raise the bigger questions that I was grappling with at midlife. And at the time, I wasn't aware that I would be grappling with my sexual identity, but the deeper questions about really who am I and what do I want my life to look like, and what is my purpose? All of those big questions were present. And that, so I looked for a scene, a moment where I could demonstrate and illustrate those. And that's how I finally landed on that opening.
Yeah. I mean, it is like magic when you figure out how to do it, but it is really addling until you do. And you have to kind of trust. It's like, I feel like from my experience and in talking to memoirists, it seems almost that we have to keep driving, keep pushing, keep thinking about it, and then also just let it go a little bit and it will come to us. You know, the way that we title things, the way that we figure out the structure, all these things. You have to show up, then at some point kind of just trust or let go that you're going to find it.
Yeah, I mean, that I'm so glad you mentioned that, because I work with memoir writers, and especially, you know, at the beginning, they feel like, oh, I've got to figure this all out. I've got to get it right. I've got to know what that first page is and, you know, all the things. And yes, we do have to write something on page one so we can move forward through that draft. But to let go of the idea that we have to get it right on the first pass is very liberating. And I remind them over and over again. I mean, I tell them the same story I've just told you about. I really didn't land on my opening until the very, very end.
I think that's really affirming. So I know we're talking a lot about the writing process, but before we move to some of the excerpts that I want you to share, I was hoping that you could reflect a little bit on the editing process itself and what aspects of your book needed the most revising when you were getting close, aside from the opening, when you were getting close to delivering the finished manuscript.
Yes. Yeah, so I queried this book for the first time in February and March of 2021. I had set a goal for myself that I wanted to be in the query process before I turned 60, and I was turning 60 in March of 2021, and I did achieve that goal, and I had a draft that I felt proud of and confident with, and I had done all my research with agents and all the things, and I sent out several batches of queries, and basically I got nothing. Absolutely. I mean, some form rejections and mostly silence. And I went back to my book coach, to Julie Arts, and I sent her my query letter, and I said, you know, do you think there's a problem with my query, or where's the problem? And she also wanted to see the first 10 pages or so. And I had a proposal. I may have even showed her the whole proposal. And then on our phone, on our call, I had heard those dreaded words, and she said something like, please don't kill me, but I don't think you're starting your book in the right place. And so we really dug into that, and I wasn't sure that I had the stomach to do a major revision at that point. I mean, I had thought I was done, and so I sat with her her comments and her feedback for a few days. And then I, of course, realized she was right. And I wanted to get the best book I was capable of writing out into the world. So with her help, I spent the next 6 to 9 months, somewhere in there, tearing that draft apart and really tearing it apart and deconstructing it and reimagining it. And I think that, and then that was the book that I actually sold. And I think that the revision process, at least for me, was a matter of each time I got more and more clear on really what my story was about. The layers, you keep thinking, oh, I know what it's about. And then, and then you're like, oh no, not really. But then you keep digging and digging, and each draft I'd get closer and closer, and themes would emerge and connections would emerge. Like I know you've read the book, Ronit, and so there's a very big theme in the book about listening to the inner voice, and also a theme about safe choices. And those emerged in various stages in my revision process. And once I understood those connections, then I was able to curate what was going to go in the book to tell those stories. And so they weren't just, you know, scenes or moments that were sharing information, but they were telling the deeper stories. So, I mean, I hate to use the cliche, but it really was that proverbial peeling of the onion and just getting clearer and clearer as to what the deeper story was.
And did you show up every day? Are you the kind of writer who you had the goal and so you kept yourself to a strict regimen, or was it sort of more feast or famine during the editing process? How did you plug away at it?
Well, I'm a very big fan of deadlines, and particularly when you're paying somebody to send your work to, or you have some kind of external deadline, or in my case, I had all of the above. I had hired a book coach. I had some external deadlines. I also had internally imposed deadlines, like that first one I mentioned. I wanted to be querying by a certain date, so I backed it up. When did that mean I had to have the draft done? When did that mean I had to have the proposal done? So deadlines were what drove me, and I wouldn't say I'm necessarily an everyday writer at all, but when I was on deadline, I would block out large chunks of time, and typically that would involve Mondays were kind of my writing days, and then it would sometimes on the weekends also, and some time during the week, but I was also running a business as a book coach. So I just blocked out significant time so I could meet those deadlines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I really want to ask you, I'm sort of toggling in my head here about having this conversation about writing about loved ones or having you talk about your work as a book coach. But let's go with the writing about loved ones first, because I want to make sure we have time for it all. And lots of memoirists struggle with writing about loved ones. In fact, I just, before this interview, was teaching a class and it came up yet again. It always comes up in memoir, what to share, what not to share. And your family features prominently in your book, your ex-husband, your mother, your sons. And there's also the consideration of the person, the first woman that you actively understood as an adult that you loved. And what was your level of worry about their reaction as you worked? And, you know, how did you write through that? How did you feel as it got closer to publication? How do you feel now?
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's a big question. So my philosophy as both a writer and a book coach is that when you're writing your first draft, you just write all the things. You don't edit yourself as far as these considerations. You just get the story out as best as you can. You get the feelings out, because I think if you start trying to think about all of the things, all of the fears, and start not going in certain directions, that you're not necessarily going to tell the truest story that you can tell. So that was my process in the beginning. Once I got a little further along, I did speak to my sons, particularly my older son, because there's some kind of somewhat sensitive material about him as a young child, and it's pretty critical to the story, but I wanted to make sure he was okay with me sharing that. And so I sat down and I talked to him about it, and he was okay, so that was great. And my mother and my sister knew I was writing a book, and you know, they had lived through the experiences. There wasn't a huge amount of conversation with them about, you know, what was actually in it, because they pretty much knew what was going to be in it. My now ex-husband also knew I was writing a book, and you know, has been very supportive. I gave all of them the opportunity to look at any sort of, not look at the manuscript as I was working on it, but in terms of when there was any kind of like email exchanges or any of those things, I wanted to make sure I had their permission to use, to use any of those kinds of material. And as far as the woman that I, the friend that I realized I was in love with, she also does know that I was working on a book. We're not currently in connection, so that, you know, that's her journey and her story. But I think that so of course you worry about what other people are going to think. And where I've landed is I feel like I have done the best job I can do to share my story, my truth, and share it with as much compassion and generosity toward the other people that were involved as I was able to. And that's where I can live with myself. I can't control how other people are going to react. That's sort of where I landed on that. I know there's a lot of different views on this. You know, there's Anne Lamott that says something like, well, if, you know, people wanted you to write nicely about them, they should have treated you better. There's that approach. And then there's, I think, Mary Carr's approach is that she shows the material to people ahead of time and vets it. So there isn't a right or wrong answer here. I think it's just doing what feels right for you.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. I definitely agree with that. Do you want to read that section? Do you want to set it up a little bit and read that section we talked about and explain who the Lalas are?
Sure. So this selection is, it's about a quarter of the way through the book, and I have met up with a group of women that I call the Lalas, and that was from a later in life's Facebook support group. But a number of us actually met in person in New York, and I'm still at this point in the story. I'm slowly coming to terms with what is true for me as far as my sexual identity, but I'm still pretty far from knowing what I'm going to do about it. And it's largely a secret from most people in my life. I mean, my husband sort of knows what's going on, but not many other people other than the Lalas. So, so I will go ahead and read. The morning after the Lala gathering, I boarded a train for New Jersey to visit my sister. Beth lived only an hour away from Manhattan, and I wasn't in a rush to return to the Montauk pressure cooker. Evan was finally healthy to be on his own. I'd been intentionally vague with Beth about my New York trip, just meeting some friends. We hadn't talked about Rini since she called our friendship weird and strange just over a year ago, and I wasn't planning to raise the subject again. Shortly after I arrived, Beth and I headed out for a walk with Sophie, her elderly Shih Tzu. We made a loop around the block and another as Sophie sniffed tree trunks in no hurry to do her business. "Hey, who are these friends you were with in New York?" Beth said. Fuck. The universe had opened doors before to hard conversations, and maybe that's what was happening again. Was I going to keep lying to my sister and my entire family forever? There was never going to be a good time to talk about this. I took a deep breath. "They're from a new Facebook group I've joined," I said. "I've been wanting to talk to you about it, but..." "What group?" "It's for women questioning their sexuality." "What?" My lips trembled. "I think I'm gay." Beth didn't say anything more, and neither did I. As we walked back to her house, I wished she would hug me, or tell me it would be okay, or say she understood, or even that she didn't understand, but still loved me. But even with her cold reaction, I felt a little lighter. My secret was out, and my sister hadn't called me weird or strange. Maybe I could tell her more. I carried my suitcase up to my nephew Rob's room, where I'd be sleeping the next two nights. Scott, my brother-in-law, was in the kitchen, prepping dinner. Beth came into Rob's room and sat down on the bed. "Tell me more about this group," she said. I told her we called ourselves the Lalas, for later in life. That these women felt like my people, the community I'd never had before. I told her about my feelings for Rini and how good it felt to finally feel less alone. "As crazy as it sounds, I'm beginning to think I might leave Evan," I said. "What are you doing, Suzette?" she said. "This is crazy. You know how obsessed you get with things. This is just like how you used to be with tennis." "My sexuality was like tennis? Are you fucking kidding me?" "Yes, I did get obsessed with things. That was just the way I was. But suggesting I was obsessed with the idea of being gay, that was insulting. This wasn't a phase or a midlife crisis, although, of course, I also hadn't wanted to believe I was gay, a fact I didn't remember in the heat of this moment. I crossed my arms. "You don't get this." "You're right," Beth said, her lips a straight line. "Can't you see how much I'm struggling? You couldn't even give me a hug earlier when I shared this unbelievably hard stuff with you. You just kept walking." She didn't say anything. I probably should have stopped there, but I didn't. "Maybe I was expecting too much from you," I said. "Maybe you're incapable of empathy." The screaming started. It seemed as if every hurt or slight Beth had felt over the past 20-some years came pouring out. Could Scott hear us down in the kitchen? "Wow," I said. "Wow is right," she said. "You drop this bombshell on me and expect me to understand? This is what you do, what you've always done. You don't tell me anything until it's a fait accompli, and then you expect me to jump on board with you." It wasn't until much later that I realized she wasn't being completely unreasonable. I wasn't the only one on a journey. The other people in my life needed time to process this too. I'd been hiding this from myself for so well, for so long, that of course I'd also completely hidden it from others, even from my sister who knew about the lezzy stuff. But in my nephew's bedroom, I wasn't thinking that way. I was just thinking about how alone and hurt I felt. And if my sister had reacted like this, how would my mother react? How would my boys? Beth and I got through dinner, but I was still shaken up. I headed up to Rob's room and went straight to the Lala page. My sister compared my obsession with thinking I'm gay to how I used to feel about tennis, I wrote. The Lalas weighed in immediately. "Yeah, because everyone's dying to be gay, right?" "You are kidding me. People act like this is a choice. Why would anyone choose this? Why indeed? Why would anyone blow up their nobody has it better than me life unless they felt they had no other choice?"
Thank you. I was really struck. I picked this for a number of reasons, including to show the relationship and to show what you're grappling with and to see this kind of support you're getting from this online group. What really struck me was that when we're in a fragile and transitional place in our lives, like you were at this point, it's so hard to tune into what we need and to find our center. And then when there's someone who's known you for so long, your whole life practically, it's very frustrating or disorienting or both to hear them say, like your sister says, how obsessed you get about these things as if exactly, I mean, obviously you just wrote it and read that part, but it's just so discounting in a way. And I'm not saying, I'm not calling your sister names. I'm just saying you captured really well how frustrating and misguiding that can be. And I feel also what I really took away from it was that you end up feeling missed or unseen, which is something we really want to be seen in our lives. And so how are you and your sister now, and how has your memoir being ready to come out or being out affected your relationship?
Yeah, that's a great question and a very timely question. We have a lovely relationship today, which I'm very happy to report. Mm-hmm. This was a very hard time for both of us and for our relationship, and it took a while to repair things and to heal. And I was nervous as the publication date approached about, you know, how was she going to react? And in fact, she and I had a conversation about whether she wanted to read the book. She wasn't sure. She wasn't sure whether it was going to be too painful, but she decided she did want to read the book. And I kind of gave her, I tried to be proactive about, you know, telling her what I had tried to do in the book. And I held my breath while I knew she was reading it. And I received a lovely text from her with a picture of the book that simply said, "I'm done. Congratulations. It's beautiful." And I cannot tell you how much that meant to me and how big of a weight I felt lifted off of me.
Okay, so here's this part of me, the not neutral interviewer, who's feeling like, you know, you're the one who went through this. You're the one who had to make this big decision about your family and your future. So I feel like as a protective, you know, instinct over you, like, why is someone so mad, or why are they the ones experiencing anger or frustration with you? You know what I mean? Like, I feel older sisterly to you in this regard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I also wonder if you weren't really angry about this. I mean, why? Where is the open arms? I accept you. I understand. I mean, that's kind of what's going on in my head.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly at the time, I'm not sure I would have necessarily called the emotion anger, but I was very, very hurt and very disappointed. And she's my one and only sibling, and we had been very close. This was a very, very difficult time in our relationship. Mm-hmm. I think the thing that, you know, it's hard for the reader to understand. Of course, we tried to communicate this on the page, but we have 50 something years of history that leads to this moment. So it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen in a vacuum. And I do think that, and this does get mentioned at various points in the book, I do think that when other people, whether it's a sibling, a parent, a friend, react in a negative way to a big change that another person is making, it's much more about them than it is about the person, and it's triggering something in them. And I mean, I'm not about to try to psychoanalyze, you know, my sister or my mother or any of the friends that were less than supportive, but I do think that when a person changes, it may trigger or threaten something in another person's life. And particularly here in a sibling relationship and in a family relationship, that one person changes, the whole relationship changes. So, you know, we had been operating a certain way for a very, very long time. I mean, I met my now ex-husband when I was 22. My sister was 20. She was in college. She grew up with him. And he was like a brother to her. And so there's a lot. It's complicated. On the surface, it does seem, you know, kind of terrible. But and it did feel really terrible in the moment. And I've tried to offer some perspective. And I, you know, I hope I've done that in the scene of stepping back and trying to understand why someone might not immediately open their arms to something that is just completely blowing up their understanding of who their sister is.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear you. And I know my wiser self knows that, as I said, I was the very, very biased just now. So what would you tell the you of 20 or 15 years ago, if you could?
Oh, boy, a lot. We'd sit down and have a big conversation. But I think kind of the three things I would say to her is, it's okay to make mistakes. You don't have to do life perfectly. And you can trust yourself. I think that's a big theme that's running through my book, is that I didn't trust myself for a very, very long time. And finally, I think I would tell her is that you're braver than you think you are. You're capable of more and braver than you think you are.
Thank you so much for reflecting on that. I love hearing that. So let's just talk in our final little time together about your work as a book coach. I'm curious when you became a book coach and what kind of work with authors you particularly enjoy doing.
Yes. Yeah, so I was doing book coaching informally for quite a while, but then I leveled up my expertise and I was certified and trained and certified through Author Accelerator in early 2020, just around the time that the world fell apart with the pandemic. So I've been doing this as a full-time business for 4 years now, and I primarily work with LGBTQ plus memoir and nonfiction writers, and I work with them one-on-one and inside a group coaching and mentorship program I have, which is called Write Yourself Out. And I love, love, love this work. I mean, I was searching for professional purpose for so many years, and I feel like I finally, you know, I'm a bit of a late bloomer in more ways than one. I finally found the work that I feel like I was meant to do on this earth. And what I particularly love doing, and I feel is kind of my superpower, is helping writers find their deeper story. Really, what is the story, you know, beneath the situation, borrowing from Vivian Gornick. That's what I really, really love, and helping them keep digging until they discover it.
You know, there's a lot of love for you in our community, our writing community. Once I posted that we're doing this book conversation for your book at Third Place Books, there were some people who wrote right away, I love Suzette.
Aww.
Or I hope I can be there. Yeah, there's a lot of support for you and the work you do. So what advice would you like to share with writers working on their memoirs?
Oh, boy. Yeah. Well, number one is be patient. This is not a writing journey that most of us can do quickly, or if we do it quickly, it's unlikely you're going to get to that deeper story. So first, be patient with yourself and keep digging, and keep digging until you do find that deeper story. I'm a big believer in planning first, which doesn't mean you figure everything out first, but to do some planning first so that you have at least a target that you're writing toward. And as you're writing, you hopefully are getting closer and closer to that bullseye. And the final piece of advice I would give is have a trusted person or people by your side as you're writing. As you know, everyone who's listening here probably knows writing is not something that we really do alone, although we are the ones that put our butts in the chair. But it is, we need our people, we need our community. And whether that's a book coach you hire, or whether it's a critique partner, critique group that you trust, but having someone or some trusted people alongside you on the journey, I think is really, really key. I could not have done it without my trusted colleagues, both paid and unpaid. So that would be my advice.
Thank you. And what memoirs would you like to mention that have been particularly helpful to you?
Too many. And of course, I've read them lots and lots, and that's what I do. But two that I'd like to call out. One is In the Dream House by Carmen Maria Machado, which is, you know, part of the queer memoir canon, and is just a beautiful book in terms of structure and very, very different experimental form. And she tells a very profound story, a story that hasn't really been told before. So that is one that I always mention to the memoir writers I work with, particularly in the queer community. And then the other memoir is an older book, but it was a book that was very important to me in my journey. And it's She's Not There by Jennifer Finney Boylan. And it's a bit more of a traditional structure memoir than certainly than In the Dream House. But there were, I read that memoir while I was going through my own struggle. And there were words in that memoir that just spoke to my soul, even though our experience was very different. Jennifer Finney Boylan was talking about gender identity and not necessarily sexual identity, but some of the internal monologue that she put down on the page, I felt as if she was in my head. And that kind of writing and the impact on the reader, it really inspired me to write my memoir, and is what I hope that I will be able to do for some of my readers.
Thank you. I'll put those in the show notes. And where can people find you?
Yeah, the best, well, two places. The best one place is yourstoryfinder.com, which is my website that has everything, my book coaching and all about my book and all the things. And then I'm most active on Instagram, and my handle on Instagram is it's yourstoryfinder, not your, because somebody else took your first. So it's yourstoryfinder. And I'd love to engage with people in either place.
Great. Thank you so much for being my guest and for having this conversation with me. I loved our time together.
Thank you so much, Renit. I really appreciate your time too.
Thank you for tuning in to Let's Talk Memoir. For more about this episode and my guest, please visit the link in the show notes or on Instagram at Ronit Plank. That's RONITPLANK. You can also follow me on Twitter, Facebook, and TikTok. If you liked this episode of Let's Talk Memoir, please go ahead and share it with your friends and subscribe. And if you have two more seconds, you can rate and review it on Apple Podcasts, which really does help other people find the show. Thank you so much for being here.